Today, we talk with Al Nielsen, former global marketer for Sega, on going up against the Goliath, Nintendo. We also talk with Olivier Blanchard and Dana Todd all about building the brand. Coming up next on Marketing Mavericks.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Welcome to Marketing Mavericks. We are all about the intersection of marketing and technology, where we talk about everything that's happening on the World Wide Web, how we use our business to build a brand, a relationship with our customers, and how that works on social media, how it works with technology, and everything in between. Today, we've got a great lineup, as always. We have the former global marketing person for Sega, who launched Sonic Hedgehog, book dropping today, where he's a contributor, and a movie shortly to follow. We're going to talk about that. We've also got Dana Todd and Olivier Blanchard, who are going to be joining us late in the show, about how to build a brand in with a interesting client or an interesting topic, and how to be prepared with maybe a loyalty program or how to retain clients. We're going to talk about that too. And our first guest, which I'm super excited, the geek girl in me for sure is excited, is Al Nielsen. He is the founder of a company, A New Spin, and he is the former global marketer for Sega, Sonic Hedgehog. Welcome, Al, to the show.
Hi, Tanya. Great to be here.
I am so excited to talk to you about what an interesting time it was when basically, you know, there was the battle of gaming when it started, Battle of the Console Wars, and you went up against such a giant. And your story is really interesting. It's listed in the book that's dropping today, Console Wars, which is written by Blake Harris, Blake J. Harris. And that can be found. Where is that on Amazon? Where is that? Where is that? Where can people find the book? We'll start there.
Wherever books are sold, you can find it on iTunes Bookstore. You can go and find it on Amazon. It's available on Kindle, Barnes and Noble, your local bookstore. And it's also available as an audiobook.
An audiobook. I love audiobooks. I'm big into the audiobook space. Okay. You started with, Sega back when, Al?
1989, just before the Sega Genesis launched. And the video game business back then was Nintendo, Nintendo, and Nintendo. Sega had about a 5% market share with our 8-bit system, and Nintendo basically ruled it. You didn't play a video game, you played Nintendo. And we were crazy enough to go and take on the giant. They had $10 for every dollar in marketing that we had, or probably even more. They had retail shelf space that was unsurpassed, and they had a brand name that everybody loved, but that didn't stop us. We had a hedgehog and a fabulous system in Genesis.
Well, I want to talk about that. I think what makes this such a powerful story isn't that we all love, well, a lot of us do anyway, love our games, and we become really attached to it. Nintendo had such a huge share of the market, and Sega was certainly, and people are very attached. I mean, you spend the money on your console, you spend the money on the games themselves, so you become very attached to the product you have, and you had to really go in and come up with something very creative at the time to gain market share and to beat a giant with very little money. I mean, you didn't have a whole lot of money to begin with. Your marketing dollars were minuscule in comparison to Nintendo. So how did you first start? Like, what was the initial, conversation around the conference room table around, okay, what should our marketing budget be? Like, how do we approach the giant?
Well, it wasn't so much how much should the marketing budget be. Sega Japan basically said, here's your marketing budget and do with it what you need to do. What we basically looked at was, how can we go up against the giant? First, we actually had another competitor, NEC, in the business who was coming out with a similar console on the same day. So we had to get them out of the marketplace so we could finally go after Nintendo. The big thing that video games were about in 1989 was, it wasn't like today. the video game business was primarily boys, 6 to 12-year-olds. Teenagers didn't play, young adults didn't play, and Nintendo wasn't targeting girls, but we know that girls were out there playing. So Sega had something big that Nintendo didn't have. We had a great arcade heritage. So when we started out, we promoted that we were bringing your arcade games home. So we had your favorite games, and they played just as they did in the arcade business. The thing was the arcade business was all about teenagers. And so that was who we were targeting, the people who had put Nintendo back in the closet. You know, Nintendo was a toy. And we actually picked up on that and said, let's go and take that reality and position Sega as the, you know, the alternative to your toy. And here's the game that you want to go and play. So what we actually did was broaden the market initially. And 20 years later, everybody plays video games, men, women, boys, girls from ages 3 to 93. And it was all because of what we did back then.
And
No,
go ahead.
You know, then what we needed to do was we needed to go and talk about the differences and between our 16-bit system, and they hadn't introduced their 16-bit system, the 8-bit system. And we went and did something that was not done in Japan and didn't go over well with our parent company, which was competitive marketing. And we did a ad campaign, which was Genesis does what Nintendo don't. Catchy line, catchy music. And it really went and set, you know, the stage for the console wars. The people who were owning Genesis really had something to go and get behind and say, yeah, here's why we're better than, you know, here's why my system is better than your 8-bit system. And it also resonated because you had to go and say, wait a minute, Nintendo's the best. What is this new system? And so that got people going. So that was setting the stage for the introduction of the Nintendo Entertainment, Super Nintendo Entertainment System, and also, very importantly, the arrival of Tom Kalinske. Tom was the former CEO of Mattel Toys. He basically reinvented Barbie into what she is today, where Barbie can be anything, as well as Masters of the Universe and He-Man. And he came in and really rallied all of us, and the rest is history.
Well, and you've got a background in the toy business as well. You've worked for Mattel and Hasbro. How important was that background in understanding the prospects that you talk about wanting to go outside of the 12-year-old boy market, which, you know, I think I had a crush on all the 12-year-old boys who were playing your games. But you know, how did that play in? I mean, you're really targeting, I guess, the moms or maybe more of the girls.
We were trying to target anyone that we could, but initially we were targeting teens because they were the ones who were in the arcades and who are playing the Sega arcade games because that's where the best games were, and that was also where the girls were. So they went out to the arcades. So we went after them initially because that was the easiest fruit that we could go and pick. But then we needed to go much, much broader. We had sports games, which were appealing not only to kids and teens, but also young adults who had played video games for years. And so things like Joe Montana football and Tommy Lasorda baseball helped to go and get young adults into the business. And then along came Sonic.
Well, you know, you mentioned sports, so I'm going to go there. I mean, during that time, I think celebrity endorsements were a really big part of marketing campaigns. We still see celebrity endorsements, of course. How did that play into, like, maybe creating your own celebrity? I mean, is that why the Sonic Hedgehog?
Well, Sonic was really, the goal of Sonic was to be our Mario. We needed something to go up as a mascot against Mario. When it was sports games, you wanted to go and play the celebrities. You didn't want to go and play Sega's version of a sports celebrity. You wanted to be Joe Montana. You wanted to go and be, you know, Buster Douglas when he was heavyweight champion, or you wanted to be Tommy Lasorda if you were a Dodgers fan. Go Giants. But so that was very important. But we needed somebody who could go and be our standard bearer. We needed somebody who could go and really be the game that everybody went. Because sports games, they have wide appeal, but not as broad as we wanted and we needed. The thing about what Sonic did was Sonic went and took us from being a teen audience into being a gaming system for everyone. Because no matter how old you were, no matter whether you love video games a whole lot or just a little, you wanted to play Sonic. He was such a character that everybody loved. The game was something that you had never seen before. You had never seen such speed. You had never seen, you know, such colors in a video game. You never had so much fun in playing it. And it really, while Mario was, you know, and it's great games. I love the Mario series, and Nintendo does a great job with them. You know, Mario just ambles around and you play him. Sonic just goes at, you know, supersonic speed. And it was something totally different in terms of what the gameplay was and really defined what 16-bit was about. And it was also our secret weapon to go and blunt the launch of the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, because we were out in the marketplace for 2 years before Nintendo came out with their 16-bit system. And we felt that we needed to go and blunt their entry, and they were basically telling all the retailers, don't worry about that Sega system. You don't want to go and carry them. Super Nintendo's coming in 1991, and we're just going to go and take over the 16-bit business. We weren't going to let that happen.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like to actually decide on, I mean, the Sonic Hedgehog is such a unique character, and you're global. So you're not just appealing to, you know, the 12-year-old U.S. American boy. You're appealing to, you know, Japan and Europe and, you know, just Asia. I mean, like all parts of the world. How did the development process come together for the Hedgehog?
It was a really strange experience because, you know, you always say that, yeah, you want to go and have a Mario killer. You want to go against whatever competitive product is out there. And a lot of times you say, let's go and develop a bunch of things and see what really comes out. But Sega Japan did something very different. They said, okay, we're going to go and focus on one game, and that's going to go and be our Mario killer. And so they had a contest internally to design a new mascot. And there were two games or designs that they liked. There was this hedgehog, and in the U.S. we said, what's a hedgehog? And the other was something that was egg-shaped characters. And in Japan, it was very, very popular and very much in terms of what their animation was. But in the U.S., it would come out very preschoolish. Sega Japan did something very, very smart. They said, this has to go and be a global product. So we're happy with these two top ones, the egg and this hedgehog. We'll leave it up to Sega of America to go and choose. And so I was shown the drawings for the two games. They didn't have any gameplay associated to them. And they say, which one do you want to be the mascot? And as I said, one was very preschool and the other was a hedgehog, albeit a blue one. And he had fangs and he was 6'8" tall and he had a rock band. And Sonic was literally the lesser of two evils, believe it or not. And they went away and they started working on it. And then as we started going and seeing some initial gameplay, we went in the U.S. and started changing the look of him, making him more appealing. We got rid of the fangs. We got rid of the rock band because rock music very much differs by category, by country. We got rid of his girlfriend named Madonna, who looked like Marilyn Monroe, so that we could go and just have, you know, the focus being on Sonic. The other thing was we started giving him an attitude, which started with his tapping his toe when you weren't playing. And it's like, my name is Sonic. It means speed. Let's go. I can't wait any longer. And so we started going and building this attitude around him. And that was really the genesis of Sonic.
You know, getting people interested in a competitive product is pretty challenging for any market, especially when you go up against such a giant who you had 5% of the market share, as you mentioned, pretty tiny, and the budget, I'm sure, compared to Nintendo, was not there. But you did something really interesting that was very grassroots, which now we kind of, I think, see on social media where people try to do something very kind of low cost. At the time, malls were a really big deal, and you guys did your own, I think, version of the Pepsi Challenge to gain some market share. Talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Once we had seen Super Mario World, which had come out in Japan, and that was going to go a year earlier, and that was going to be our competitor, we knew that Sonic was going to be really good. And we actually did play tests with Nintendo owners and Mario lovers to let them play the new Mario that they had never seen before in Sonic. And the interesting thing was that 80% of the players, Mario lovers, chose Sonic over Mario. So we knew we had a secret weapon. We went and kept it very, very quiet and didn't show Sonic until the day that Nintendo introduced Super Famicom or Super NES at the Consumer Electronics Show, and we unveiled Sonic. And we actually had a screen in our booth that showed Sonic and Mario side by side and let the retailers decide, you know, which is really the 16-bit unit. And there was no comparison. Literally, Mario paled in comparison. It was slower. It wasn't as beautiful looking. We then went out to the malls 2 months before Nintendo launched, because we said, we're nice guys, let us launch Super NES for Nintendo. And we let people go and play Mario, the new Mario on Super NES, and Sonic the Hedgehog side by side, and then choose which one they liked. So every week we were able to go and announce publicly 78%, 82%, et cetera, prefer Sonic over Mario. And this started going and getting the buzz out about Sonic. And it also went and said, this Mario isn't so special. And we started in Nintendo's backyard in Seattle. And the interesting thing is the highest preference for Sonic over Mario was in Nintendo's hometown.
So so there's a question coming up about the Sonic name in the chat room. So is it the Sonic Hedgehog? How do you refer to him?
Sonic's middle name is The. And here's how it all came about. I got our lawyer sent over the trademark applications, and wanted me to review them. And I looked at it, and it had The capitalized. And I was getting ready to take a post-it note and to send them a note. No, it's a lowercase T. And then I said, you know, this would be a good story to go and tell some reporter someday. And I can go and use it in some conversation. So I left it exactly as that. And what's interesting is if, you know, you Google me, the first thing you find out about is that I gave Sonic his middle name of The. So that is my claim to fame, among other things.
That's a pretty good claim to fame. I love the idea that you did believe so much in your product that you went out to challenge people to, you know, think of, you know, we've replaced your coffee with Folgers crystals. You basically are replacing Nintendo with Sega, and that was a really big success for you. But what happened when you upgraded Sega? You came out with like the new version of Sega. Not everybody likes change, right? So that was another challenge that you had to overcome.
Yeah, one of the problems, I guess you're talking about 32X and Saturn. Is that it? Or afterwards, or replacing the Sega Master System?
The Sega Master System.
Oh, well, the Sega Master System was very interesting because, you know, we had a small market share compared to the NES, but we had very, very loyal owners. And they also had become very vocal because, you know, on the school playgrounds, they were, you know, being kidded, going, oh, you play Sega Master System. Come on, get with it. Nintendo's where it's at. And they were able to go and vocalize why the Master System was better. And what was very interesting was that when Genesis came out, there was a very quick adoption and changeover from the Master System to the Sega Genesis, because they wanted to go and say, hey, I've got the system that you really is number one. You've got an old 8-bit NES, you're not with it anymore. Genesis is where it's at. But the other thing that we did was what we call our most important least selling product, or worst selling product. And that was something called the Power Base Converter. And it was an adapter that plugged into Genesis so that you could go and play all of the Sega Master System games on your Sega Genesis system. So therefore, mom didn't have a reason to go and say, wait, I invested so much money in all of these 8-bit games, you want to get rid of them? And the kids could go and say, but mom, with this $35 adapter, you can go and play all of that. And so that was a very important part of our strategy. It also fit in perfectly with what Nintendo did, because they had kept telling people one of the 10 ways to choose a video game system, and they actually had a brochure, was choose the system with the most games. So when Super NES came out, they had 20. We had over 100 Genesis games, and then we had 150 Sega Master System games. So we were actually able to use Nintendo's own brochure against them and say, see, Nintendo says that you need to buy a Sega Genesis and not a Super NES.
That's really a great way of turning their campaign around at them. Besides creating the middle name, The, what would you say is the biggest accomplishment, whether it be for yourself or for the entire team of promoting Sonic at the time?
It was literally Sonic Tuesday, because Sonic Tuesday Sonic 2 was the sequel to Sonic. And whether it's a movie or a video game, sequels aren't necessarily that great. But we had a game that played even better, looked even better, was faster. Sonic had more attitude. He also had a new friend, a fox with two tails. And we wanted to go and make this really the game that would make you, no ifs, ands, or buts, want to choose a Genesis over a Super NES. And so what we did was we created the world's first global launch of a video game system or a video game cartridge. Normally, a video game would premiere in Japan and then a few weeks later in the U.S. and a month or so later in Europe. And we wanted to create basically a blockbuster movie around Sonic 2. And so therefore doing a global launch. The other thing was video games had never been available like a movie, you know, opening Friday. Well, video games depended on when, you know, distribution centers could go and get the product out. So it could be in some Toys R Us stores this week, some other Toys R Us stores next week. Everybody's getting it at a different time frame. So what we created was we literally were air freighting cartridges into 13,000 retailers the night before. We started the promotion 2 months before, where we were doing in-store demos where people could go and play Sonic 2 months before it was available. And we did it at stores across the country as well as 3 Air Force bases just to go and build buzz. We were doing pre-orders, and it was the first pre-order for a video game, where if you went and pre-ordered a Sonic the Hedgehog cartridge, you got a free Sonic 2 T-shirt that the retailers actually went and paid for. So we were creating tremendous traffic. We were also getting retailers to build Sonic boutiques in their stores. So not only were they selling the Sonic 1 cartridge, the pre-ordering Sonic 2, but also selling all of the licensed merchandise that we had. And it all came down to Sonic Tuesday, which was the first global event. And stores were opening at midnight where you could come in and get your Sonic 2 cartridge. We started in Japan, and then we went to Europe, and then went to the U.S., we did video news releases that covered our marketing from around the world, and we turned it into a global event, and we turned it into the way video games are being marketed today. I had a big smile when a few months later, Mortal Kombat came out, and it came out on Mortal Monday, trying to copy what we had done with Sonic Tuesday. So it really started to change that video games are not just something that appear, but that are something that you need to look forward to and really become event marketing in their own.
What would you see as a pioneer kind of in the space of marketing in gaming changed in the last 20 years? So, you know, from marketing a product like a console with Sega and Sonic the Hedgehog, what would you see the difference between now and how the gaming industry has evolved?
First of all, the whole idea of marketing has become much more instantaneous thanks to social media, so that there's really getting the message out there is much faster. Previously, the way that you got the message out was either through the video game magazines or through TV advertising. And TV advertising is not as important now. The video game business has also changed to a slightly higher age group in terms of the emphasis. So you're seeing more teenagers and young adult-oriented games than you are family games across the board. Also, the consoles are becoming You know, being able to go and do downloadable content, or now being the, you know, Microsoft is now developing their own TV shows that you can actually go and watch on your Xbox. And so it's kind of like, take a Netflix model, take a video game model, and put them into one console. So it's becoming more of an overall entertainment system than just a video game system.
You actually talked about, and I don't know if you, you know, you mentioned this a little bit, but the Sega Vision, which is the magazine that you launched, is today what I would consider in general content creation to build loyalty with your customers. We talk about that in social media all the time, you know, create content that your customers will like and they'll keep coming back to you because you're educating them. And you did that with Sega Vision. How big a part of your marketing and campaign for loyalty and retention was that?
It was very important in the early days because we needed to go and, especially in the transition from the Sega Master System to the Sega Genesis, we needed to go and give those Sega Master System owners reasons to go and tell their mom and dad why they need to go and upgrade. We needed to go and give them reasons so that when they were on the playground, they can go and say, here's why Sega Genesis is more important. So we were going to be able to go and create that. Create those reasons. The other thing that we were able to do was to go and help start go and build the brand image with them and be able to take them behind the scenes of games, go and show them what was really cool about Sega. And so it was very, very important in the early days. And then as we started getting Sega Genesis owners, we were able to go and help go and promote game sales. So therefore, we could go and tease new games about them, help them to go and play games better. We had to go and discontinue it because it just became sending out this beautifully produced magazine to millions of people. It was just eating up too much of our marketing budget. And we needed to go and be able to utilize those very, very rare dollars that we had. As I said, Nintendo had $10 for every dollar I had. But Sega Visions in the early days had definitely done its job.
What was the end result of all of this? And there's so much more that we are not going to be able to get to, but I think is mentioned a lot in the console wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the battle that defined a generation by Blake J. Harris. Where did you land from the standpoint of market share at your point of departure?
We went from 5% to 63%.
That's huge. It's exciting and huge. And you did this with a lot of grassroots efforts, some really strategic marketing, and having a great product, as you've mentioned. I mean, the quality of your product had to be there. You can't just market something and it's not good. You have to actually have something good to start off with. Very exciting story. What is probably the biggest takeaway for marketers if they pick up the book Console Wars, that they're, besides the fun, you know, Sonic conversation, Sonic the Hedgehog, what are marketers going to get from this?
Marketers are really going to go and see, you know, the strategic importance of analyzing your competition from A to Z, anticipating what their moves are, understanding how they will respond or won't respond in Nintendo's case to what you're doing. It's also the importance of having a team who can go and take an idea and, you know, take it from just one small area into 100 different areas. So what can you go and do from a PR standpoint, from a social media standpoint, from a product standpoint, from a grassroots standpoint, and have them all work together seamlessly so that 2 + 2 isn't just 4, 2 + 2 is 44. And that was one of the important things that we were able to do. It's also the importance of really knowing your product and knowing how consumers are going to go and feel about your product and understand. You know, when we were working with Michael Jackson on the Moonwalker game, Michael could go and look at a product and literally go and say, here's what players are actually going to go and say when they see this part of the game. And being able to go and excite people about those elements, because that's what goes and helps really separate you from your competitors.
If somebody's following you and they're following the book, you mentioned to me, this is actually, they're already talking about making this into a movie, which I would be really excited to see. Talk a little bit about the plans for the movie.
Absolutely. The movie rights have actually been sold to Scott Rudin, who produced The Social Network, Moneyball, and a lot of your favorite TV shows. And Sony Pictures has bought the distribution rights to it. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg have joined the project, and they are going to be writing the screenplay, and Seth is actually going to be directing the movie. So we don't have a date yet for when that's happening, but you know, it's amazing that here's this book about your life, and all of a sudden it's going to become a feature film. In addition, Blake Harris, who wrote the book, is doing a documentary about it, and he's actually filmed all of the participants from both the Sega and Nintendo sides and is actually editing it as we speak. So it's the book, it's the audiobook, it's the documentary and the feature film. And it all starts today with the publication of Console Wars.
Exciting stuff. That's Al Nilsson. He is the former global marketer for Sega during Sega of the American brand during Genesis era. Very exciting stuff. And you're the founder of A New Spin. And do you want to hang on and join the conversation, or do you got to check out?
Happy to do it.
Awesome. So we're going to talk more about building the brand, and we're going to talk about how that really works to today and how some of the challenges that even Al went through at the time are still in effect today. And what are we doing about building the brand, creating content, coming up with a PR campaign, and taking on the big guy? We're joined now by Dana Todd and Olivier Blanchard. Dana Todd, who is a founder of something, an organization called Sempo. She is also been on the board, chairman of the board for Sempo. And she is currently the chief marketing officer at Aftermath, which is a biohazard, go in after the crime scene kind of company. We'll talk a little bit about that. We've also got Olivier Blanchard, who is the author of Social Media ROI and the Nemesis Engine series, and that's his newest book. And he's also known as the Brand Builder. Welcome both of you to joining us to the show.
Thanks for having me. That was a really fascinating first segment. I feel like I wasn't a huge game fan, but I owned a hedgehog actually briefly.
And also my
senior, when I studied advertising, our senior project was to save, at the time it was Atari. They were dying. And so our mission was to save Atari.
Well, you know, I'm super big fan. Love your hair too, Dana, by the way. Like if you're watching this and not listening to it, Dana, you just got to get to know. Dana has the funkiest hair. I totally love her hair. Olivier Blanchard, always the troublemaker. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I learned something today. I have like virtually nothing to add because it was like the perfect marketing program.
Beautiful.
You learned something. I'm kind of just impressed. You know what, Al? I'm telling you, Olivier never says he learned something except just now. So.
No, I'm impressed because I look at this and it's the exact opposite of what I mostly see today, which is this was real strategy. And it wasn't just, you know, looking at how much money a marketing program had and slapping content together and publishing it to however many channels you could. This was clever. This is like Game of Thrones stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is what makes this story, part of what makes this story so fascinating, is going up against and not having the resource that we have today of social media and the internet. You really had to be incredibly strategic and creative. And what was done then, I would say more grassroots, going out to the malls and you know, engaging customers is kind of what we're doing today using the internet. We're doing it less face-to-face, I think, and more face-to-face over the web. You know, I would say, Dana, you and I have talked a lot about, you know, content creation and reaching customers, and you've been in the publication space, and now you work for a really interesting company, and I want to get to that in a second. But what would you see is parallel for what Al did in working for Sega and launching the Sonic Hedgehog to today, and what maybe be a challenge for kind of an underdog today going up against a big giant?
I think you see success stories every day of underdogs winning using primarily digital media. But I think the cleverest ones actually do still embrace the meat space, as it were. And I think that's still very important. I think the face-to-face, and we're seeing it every day. You look at Instagram. Instagram is not just about taking pictures. It's about documenting what's happening in your real life in real time. So while digital media accelerates the sharing and the reach of your real life, that you still have to have that Genesis experience. You still have to have that starting point of emotion. And I think it's a lot harder to get that human emotion out of a purely digital experience. So I'm a big believer that you can't just substitute digital for certainly for strategy and certainly for creating opportunities that are more shareable.
So before social media, I mean, there was, again, grassroots efforts. You were doing a lot of different things. What would you do today, Al, that, you know, having access to the internet, if you had it to do starting today, using social media, what would be one thing that you think maybe somebody else should consider doing that you would have done with the Sonic Hedgehog?
I think the important thing is not going and substituting what we think about a product to what our players and users are thinking about a product. And so be utilizing social media to get the word out, not from Sega's lips, but from our players' lists, and finding ways to go and utilize social media so that they can actually talk about what they're thinking about Sonic or Toe Jam and Earl or any of it. And also, if it was the same environment where there was this war between Sega and Nintendo, was finding ways to go and, allow some nice shots to go back and forth between the two. But once again, having it come out of the lips of our actual players and users.
And you did that then, and you did such a great job of it. It was exciting to hear. And now I think a little scary because, you know, you're inviting customers to talk about your brand and your product, and they could easily have said, you know what, not liking it. We don't love it. We want to stick with our what we use now. But you took it on because you believed in what you did today with the power of social media, as Dana pointed out, with like Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or some of those platforms where people are pretty immediate with their reaction to products. Who do you look at today, whether it's in the gaming space, Al, or maybe another industry, who's doing a really good job of immediately going to the internet, engaging their customers, and, as to your point, listening to what they have to say?
What's actually interesting is from the toy space is what Lego is actually doing. Lego is doing a great job segmenting their market against a number of different target markets and then going and both soliciting feedback but also creating content for their customers.
Brand builder, Olivier, yes. Blanchard, you love to tear down the brands and build them back up, if you will. What would you say that, you know, you see in comparison to what Sega's done with the Hedgehog and industry in general? They did such a great job, as you pointed out, and it is a great example. Who's doing something really powerful today like that?
You know, there are a number of companies that do certain things very well. Whether they're challenger brands or they're established brands. So on the established brand side, Ford has done a really good job. You know, I'm a huge fan of what Scott Monty's been able to do at Ford over the last few years. You're starting to see a little bit of that in the luxury and retail industry. So Burberry's, for instance, is using social channels well. But there's a component here that I think is much more important than the channels. I mean, we can talk about social media and how that increases the velocity of whatever campaign that you want to put together. It increases the scale at a lower cost when used properly with quote unquote traditional channels, but I think that the real core of this is that, and especially in the U.S., challenger brands have a little bit of an advantage, which is kind of counterintuitive. We think that the Goliath, the giant established kind of master brand like what Nintendo was at a certain time, has an advantage, but it really doesn't. The challenger brand has kind of like an automatic plug-in mythology that goes along with it that can be leveraged really easily. And we've seen that with Apple. We saw that with Sega. And, you know, the first part of that is having a great product and having good people and having a story to tell, but also fitting into that dynamic of David versus Goliath. Everybody likes a challenger, whether it's Rocky or Sonic the Hedgehog, or you know, at one time the Apple computer. It's you're challenging the status quo. You're the rebel, and that makes you cool. And that gives people a choice. It feels like progress. It seems like something that has more value than what is already there and what everybody else has. And that's always going to appeal to a certain percentage of the population. And so, you know, in this case, as in many others, a company that's able to tap into that and to create a tribe and go really deep with its core fan base and start there and just kind of spin out and scale from there is always going to have an advantage over the challenger brand because they're on the offensive. And it's a positive offensive, and they're basically calling the shots. So if the trick to that is not losing momentum, it's carrying that over the first 6 months and then over the first 18 months and then being able to do that for 5, 6, 8, 10 years. And that's where companies usually end up faltering a little bit because people change roles and strategies change and the momentum can be lost. But if you can maintain that momentum and stay true to that core story, to that brand mythology, you've got a winner. It's just a matter of you know, keeping your eye on the ball and being patient.
So, Al, you've had a lot of huge success, obviously, while you were there. We're talking about how great it was and how wonderful everything was and how successful you were. What was something you did wrong? What was something that didn't go the way that you had predicted or was a big challenge for you that maybe you would do differently today?
I think the big problem that we had was we started to lose focus. Our eye was being taken off the ball as we were being strongly encouraged and then made to go onto the next generation hardware before we had really maximized what we had done with the Genesis system. And so it was going and coming out with the 32X, which was an accessory which cost as much as the main unit and didn't have the software support behind it. And then even confusing not only our consumers, but retailers and our developers, third-party developers, coming out with the Sega Saturn system closely behind, and then the Sega CD system even before then. And so it was like, I need to go and spend $500, $600, $700 on new hardware when the name of the game is the game. So we took our focus off of the games themselves and the focus went on to new hardware. And that was really part of what caused our downfall.
What do you think about the way games have changed from the standpoint of advertising? I mean, today you play games, there's, you know, the freemium versions, there's like free versions, there's paid versions, there's all kinds of advertising as a part of, you know, whether it's pop-ups or embedded into the game. How do you feel about that? I mean, is that progress? I mean, maybe advertisers and brands like it, but how does the gamer, do you think the gamer perceives that?
I in terms of embedded advertising, if it feels like it belongs within the game, if it feels somewhat organic, I think it's okay. If it just becomes, you know, people don't like pop-ups, they don't like anything that takes their mind away from the game experience. You know, people talk about kids playing video games being zoned in. And to the extent of, you know, so nothing else matters. And that's what the gaming is all about. And if you go and start throwing in an ad that's going to go and distract from that, you're taking away from the experience, not just the gaming experience, but also the brand experience. Free, in terms of freemium, free is a magic word. Everybody loves free. And if they can go and add on new levels and be for just, you know, a few dollars, that becomes very, very exciting. But it also dramatically changes, you know, what a marketer can go and do in terms of getting the word out.
Dana, your business today is super interesting, and I think interesting to me. Okay, I'll just say that. I love kind of this idea.
It's interesting to a lot of people. It's interesting to me. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. And this idea that, you know, how do you market you know,
crime scene cleanup.
I don't even know how to say, like, it's awkward to even say, but you know, you've done a lot of different things. This is so unique and different. You actually mentioned to me a scenario too, where, you know, you have to, so a little bit about your business is that you go in and you're contacted about, you know, whether it's so who's your client? Is it a business? Is it the law enforcement? Is it a family? So I mean, who's your client?
It is families primarily. The bulk of our work is residential, but we actually have a pretty significant amount of revenue coming from commercial. So our broad classification is biohazard remediation, but most people think of it as crime scene cleanup because that's what you see on TV. But believe it or not, in this very scary world we live in, full of superbugs, the exact same tactics that we use to clean up a homicide or a suicide situation can also be used to clean norovirus or AIDS or hepatitis in a food manufacturing facility or a hotel room or even an office or a locker room. We clean a lot of locker rooms with MRSA and things like that. So, yeah, this is our website. It's a service-based business. We don't do a lot of consumer advertising. We do market primarily through people who can connect us out in communities, either funeral homes, law enforcement, first responders, fire departments, health departments, pretty much victims assistance. A lot of victims advocacy groups refer our services. So it's not the kind of thing that you can just, you know, take out a TV commercial or put a big billboard up, although we have occasionally tried that. But it's just our secondary tagline is probably, we hope you never have to call, but if you do, we'll be there.
Well, and it's a necessary evil. Unfortunately, there's lots of things that we don't like to need at some point. We know we will. You mentioned something to me off air that I think is really interesting, and it comes from a standpoint of being prepared, right? And even though you aren't heavily marketing, proactively, you also have to be prepared for kind of a situation, right? Whether it's a social media crisis or whatever. You talked about a reporter who happened to be jogging by one of the businesses where you were doing your job, and she, you know, peeked in the door and took a picture, and it went on to social media. Talk about that, and how do you, as a business, prepare for whatever that might be, whatever kind of crisis? How did you guys handle that?
Well, let me back up actually a couple of years and talk about how the company in general has always, prior to my coming on board, maintained a bit of secrecy and veil of that. And it wasn't because they didn't want people to understand our industry. It was because we have a lot of sensitivity about the media, because we are dealing with sensitive crime scenes or virus situations, things where we're trying to prevent media from being involved and from snooping, basically, to you know, there's a lot of privacy concerns and sensitivity for families and businesses. So we had always been a bit camera shy, other than being reactive to reporter inquiries who really wanted to tell the story their way. And even today, I get calls all the time from reporters who want to know, like, oh, you know, is it like CSI? And can we come and follow you around and look at crime scenes and talk about it? It very much glorifies the blood and guts aspects of what we do. And we didn't own our own story. We didn't have a foundation of deciding what our story was. We let other people tell our story for us. So a few years ago, when we ran into some problems with some complaints online, as well as some negative media, we had some lawsuits that were pending, and the press turned on us, and suddenly the press weren't our friends, and they didn't want to do anything except take that same emotionalism and turn it against us. And because we had not been proactive in having our own voice, our own story, we didn't have our staff prepared to deal with this, we found ourselves very much on the run. And then when, worst of all, we had a Google penalty, and what little positive press coverage we had and our websites pretty much disappeared, leaving nothing but a very, very negative story about our brand. And what I know from being inside for a year now is that internally, I get two or three letters every week from families thanking us for what we do and portraying a very different story. And my struggle as the chief marketing officer is to help us tell those stories again. So the specific situation you referenced, one of the ways I do that is literally by media training our technicians and our supervisors out in the field. So we never know when somebody's going to be jogging by with a cell phone and turn what is a standard cleanup into a press emergency, just because, again, of that heightened freak out that people do when they see someone walking around with a bunny suit and a respirator.
Well, and you talk about Google penalties, which is a whole nother show. I think we should talk about that. Yeah. But just briefly describe what you mean there in case somebody really doesn't understand what that define that for them.
A Google penalty? Google's your friend. Go to your Zen happy place. So if you are too aggressive or try to create an unfair advantage with your web assets in Google, there's a very high likelihood that at some point you will get busted and your site will not rank as highly as it did before, and in fact may be completely ejected from the database. And we found ourselves with a pretty significant set of not one, but four penalties on two sites that were the result of aggressive tactics from consultants that we had hired prior to my coming on board.
And I would like to do a whole show actually on just kind of this idea of, gaming the system, you know, how to get Google to recognize your brand, link placement strategies, as it were, and what that means. So, Olivier, the brand builder, you talk in your first book, Social Media ROI. What would be the ROI that you would take away from Al's conversation about how Sonic the Hedgehog was launched and what their benefit was? I mean, it's clearly not social media, but they did a great job, as we talked about. And what would your take be on that?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about ROI, I just look at the spend and then compare it to the revenue that was on the back end. I mean, you're talking about like a starting point of 5% market share and an end point, at least, you know, at the end of that particular program, of 63% market share. So there are real numbers in the background that could actually be calculated. But, you know, for anything else, it's not just building a brand, it's building a community, it's building a market. And on top of that, being able to do it in somebody else's backyard that had basically ownership of that market with a fraction of their resources, it's unheard of. I mean, it's extremely, extremely rare to see that kind of success, however short-lived it may have been in the long run. But it's extraordinary. I mean, that thing, it's not even about the console wars to me. I mean, this is a case study in what to do and how to do it right and how to apply that to different companies. It's I want to keep talking to them because it's seriously, this is like the smartest segment I've heard on any program in a very long time.
I will definitely have you back, Al. So Dana and Olivia, get out of here. No, I'm just kidding. Get out of town. I know. I kind of was like, gosh, I got too many guests on my show today. Al's so good. I was telling him earlier I had a couple of other people we had booked, but you know, Al, the story is great. It's really exciting to. I think people definitely want to check out the book. What's on your radar right now, Al? What are you looking at? What is something that really excites you in the marketing or digital marketing space?
Yeah, the thing that I look at is really not bits and pieces of it. I really try to go and say, for the projects that I'm working on, how does something go and fit in? And I try not to go and say, here's the tools, what do I do with them? It's kind of like, here's what's the challenge and go look the other way. So it's probably not the answer that you want, but it's really the approach that I take. It all starts with the product and then the marketing goes from there. And the other thing is what can you go and do that nobody has done before, utilizing these various tools.
And Dana, what is on your radar right now? What's something that you're looking at or a big challenge for you that you're paying attention to?
Well, I'm still dealing with negative media stuff. So I'm still in a constant battle to build more positive assets. So that's priority number one for me right now. But long term, it's important for me to, and actually I'm glad earlier we talked about the longevity. We're actually in the reverse situation. We are the market leader. We are the Goliath in our industry. We've got a lot of ankle biting going on. So I'm in a constant need to maintain our position and defend against that. So part of doing that is that consistency piece. Whether you are the Goliath or the David, consistency is key, and you can't just keep jumping around and jumping around and jumping around. And so for me, whatever I do, it's creating this consistent pull through in every single placement that we do. So I can't be everywhere. I have a small and limited team, but we've really got to hone in on the consistency. So that sounds really boring. It's not sexy. It's not technology. It's about just picking a road, sticking on it, inviting others to join, and trying to leverage what we have here. So I'm actually doing a lot of training with our supervisors right now, teaching them how to be part of the conversation as well.
If somebody wants to follow you and they have more questions, maybe even about content, which I have to say this, Dana is the master of understanding content creation and how to use that content to either build loyalty or attract customers or educate customers. It's just really, really smart guy. We'll definitely have you back. But if somebody wants to follow you and they want to connect with you, how should they do that, Dana?
Twitter is so easy. Dana Todd, DanaTodd.
It is pretty easy. And she's super engaging, by the way. Olivier, if somebody wants to connect with you and they want to find out about what you're doing, how should they do that?
Well, there's olivierblanchard.net. Don't confuse me with the world famous economist who works for the IMF. That's the other Olivier Blanchard. He's more famous than I am and considerably smarter. On Twitter, it would be at the Brand Builder, which, by the way, I'm not the Brand Builder. The Brand Builder was just the name of the blog, which has changed now. So I probably need to change my Twitter handle. And what I'm up to, I am working to launch a new agency with a few really cool partners. So that's still kind of in the works, but in a few months we'll be able to talk about it in more detail. And I'm writing the sequels to the Peacemakers, so the Nemesis Engines 2 and 3. I'm fitting between projects. So it's trying to balance the business aspects of my life and the fiction writing stuff. But that's pretty exciting.
So somebody can understand what that book is. Explain that a little bit.
Okay, so briefly is difficult. But essentially, it's a trilogy and it's fiction and it's kind of an alternate historic novel that takes place in World War I. And it has a few elements of steampunk, so it's kind of like old-time Jules Verne and H.G. Wells sci-fi set in World War I, and there's adventure, and there's revenge, and there's technology, and all kinds of crazy stuff going on.
Exciting stuff. And you will have to change. You know, if you want me to stop calling you the Brand Builder, then change your Twitter handle. What?
Yeah, no, I need to do that.
And Al, thank you so much for joining. I can't wait to have you back. I'm excited to read the rest of the book, and I'm excited for the movie, too. So if somebody wants to connect with you, maybe they want to hire you or just find out more about the book and that sort of thing, how should they do that?
Follow me on Twitter at Al Nilsen, A-L-N-I-L-S-E-N.
That's so easy. You guys are all so easy. And I appreciate everyone coming on the show today. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Gosh, I tell you, normally such a rowdy group. I will tell you for sure, Dana and Olivier, this was the quietest I've ever seen them. So I can't wait to have them back. And maybe I have to find a topic to really kind of push their buttons. Dana's doing some great things. And if you want to learn about Sempo, you should. We'll have her come back and talk about what that is and what that means. And I took your advice, too, on Google. We'll do a show all about Google. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in for Episode 6 of The Marketing Mavericks. We're going to check out. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag Marketing Mavericks, or you can email me if you've got some show ideas and maybe what you think we should talk about on the show. You can email at mavericks@twit.tv. Follow me on Twitter as well at Tanya Hall Radio. Use the Marketing Mavericks hashtag. And we look forward to hearing from you. Otherwise, tune in next Tuesday for the next episode of Marketing Mavericks. Everybody.
Hey, that was fun.
Well, sorry. Yeah. The couldn't two, Al, I think you mesmerized these two because usually they're like all at it, especially Olivier, man, that guy.
The power of the hedgehog.
That's the thing, though. I mean, this was brilliant. This is the best thing that's happened to me all week. I keep having to, and I don't know if it's because I follow the wrong people, I spend too much time on social media, but no, actually it's not true. I deal with agencies and marketing professionals, quote unquote, and they're just dumb as rocks, and they seem to be getting dumber every day. So this is a huge breath of fresh air.
Dumb as rocks.
You know, yes. We didn't talk about my major accomplishment.
Which was?
Which is?
In 1989, no one in America had any idea what a hedgehog was.
Really?
That's true. You've got our audience laughing here. John's laughing.
It's so literally because you knew what a groundhog was. Hedgehogs were only known in the UK. And we had to not only introduce, you know, this giant 6'8" blue guy, but introduce, help let people know what a hedgehog was. So that,
well, see, now this is when you probably should have marketed to women, because we all read Alice in Wonderland, and she played golf with flamingos and hedgehogs.
John mentioned somebody, he watches Monty Python, so he knew. But you're right. Al, you're kind of laying the groundwork for having you back on the show. Sorry. You're going to have to.
I understand that. I think we should just go and do hedgehogs in the world and how they relate.
Next show title.
I may have spaced out when you were talking about that, but that soundbite that you guys have, did that come later? When was that introduced? Because
that was actually introduced in 1992 when we changed ad agencies to Goodby Silverstein Partners. And Olivier, it's kind of what you were talking about, where, you know, keeping the momentum going. And what was interesting was here we were this underdog, and then all of a sudden we became a leader. And so, therefore, the onus goes on the leadership. So what we actually did to try to prevent the downfall was to go and have a whole new advertising campaign and a whole new ad agency. And this is when Goodby came in with Welcome to the Next Level, and where we had TV ads that were with 100 cuts in a 30-second commercial. It was literally what you were seeing on MTV, but it had never been seen in a TV commercial. And then we learned that a takeaway in a 15-second version was 80% of the takeaway you'd get in a 30-second. So we could actually double our marketing budget by just running 15s instead of 30s. And so, once again, it was another way to go and say, how do we go and maximize our marketing dollars? And Goodby helped us do that. And the sonic scream was a major part of that. And that wasn't even the major tagline that they presented. But if you read Console Wars, the whole story the Sega Scream, literally on his deathbed almost, is in the book.